Hey, good morning, everyone. Let me call the Mesa City Council study session of Thursday, May 15th, 2008 to order. The first item is to review items that will be on the regular council meeting for May 19th. Let's see, we have... Yeah, right. So let's go through the items again like we normally do, a page at a time. Page 1, 2. We have some appointments from the recommendations from Judicial Advisory Board for reappointment of magistrates. I believe 4 A and B, I have conflicts on the Mesa Town Center Improvement District. These are public hearings, but I will not be voting on the resolution. Mike, do you have the same thing on Town Center?
Yes, sir.
All right. Okay, page 3. I have some general plan minor amendments out at the Falcon Field area. On page 3, page 4. Minor general plan amendments again. Right, and the ordinance, page 5.
Question on 7B, do we have a conflict?
I wrote Keno conflict on 7B. Is there a conflict? Is that the town center for a minor general plan amendment?
Mayor, I think the question would be, are these changes in the text, is that going to potentially increase or decrease any of the property value that you might have in the town center area?
Patrick, do you want to just me explain what this is?
Is it for owners of property, in my case, in which I do own property in the downtown square?
Mayor and council members, this general plan amendment is really more of a housekeeping item. These are existing land use categories. We're just what happened was this concept plan was approved in 1999, then incorporated into the city's general plan in 2002. The concept plan had land use categories for our land use map, but they were not defined. And what we're doing now is just, again, a housekeeping item to let the customers know how staff interprets what these land use categories mean. So they're excuse me, there's really no impact to the property values because it's just, again, clarifying how we define these categories.
So if I have a TCB2, or what it used to be, I think, is that change to entitle the property to any other reduced setbacks or anything else that takes place?
Mayor and council member, no. This is the general plan. That's a zoning designation. This is more of the general plan, and the general plan designation does not change for any properties. Again, we're just defining what those land use categories mean.
Mayor, I'll talk to Patrick. What I'm hearing is no, there will not be a conflict, but I'll check and get more details and let you know by Monday.
Okay. Tom?
On the same topic, every other minor general plan or major general plan amendment we've had has had to go through the ordinance route. Can we change the general plan by resolution?
No, a general plan is by resolution, Councilmember Rawls. It's the zoning that comes through by ordinance. Let me ask, where's John?
You're right. Okay. So I just want to know legally we can change the general plan that's been adopted by the people by resolution.
Yes.
That's all I wanted to know. Fine, thank you.
All right. Then we get into liquor license applications, bottom of page 5. They continue on page 6. Scott?
I'm just curious what the story is on 8D. It says that there's a petition of objection. Is this a new liquor license? Are they up to code and it's the neighborhood?
Yes, Mayor and Councilmember Summers. They have, there's no building permit issue here. It's a neighborhood group that has submitted petition because they don't feel that it best serves the interest of the neighborhood. It's near Mesa Drive and Broadway, and they feel that they have enough service in the area and they don't need another store of this type.
Okay. Mayor and Council, if I might, the administrative code which sets out the criteria that the council can use when deciding whether to recommend approval or disapproval, it does include this as an item. So council can consider the thoughts and input of the surrounding neighbors with regard when deciding its recommendation.
It's a recommendation to the state. We don't issue the licenses.
That's correct.
Right. And Monday night, they will have representatives from the neighborhood and the applicant at the meeting.
Is there any criteria for the petition on the number of signatures? I know they had several pages in this one, but do they need 5% of the neighbors within a certain geographic area? Is there any states?
There's no criteria.
So you could get a petition with your signature on it and file it as a petition?
That's correct.
All right.
And Mayor, that doesn't change the vote at all, as like it does in a legal protest for zoning. The vote is still 4 would carry the motion.
Okay. All right, that's page. Any other questions on that? Contracts then begin on item number 9. And it continues over on page 7. There is two items, 9C and 9Q, that have the laptop computers. They're the same price, but one is buying the extended warranty and the other is not. Is there a reason why one department did that and one didn't? One's police, and I think the other one, I can't remember what 9Q is, utilities.
Mayor, council members, Cheryl Butler from the police department. That was an oversight on our part on those 14 items. We expected to have the fourth year of warranty in there to cover the cycle period. That will add approximately $500 to this purchase price that you see before you now.
Actually, I think it's $278. If the extended warranty is the same as the other, is there something else that goes with it?
No. So I that was just the number that I was given as to what the difference would be in case this question did come before you.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That's page 7. All right. I was just curious to see if one department was getting a better deal and they got the same price.
The question that came up in our review, we want to make sure that the warranty matches up our cycle program, so we'll make that adjustment.
All right. That's page 8, or additional contracts. It will be interesting to see if 9H remains on the consent. I have done towing contracts, I think, for the last 18 years, and they hardly ever go on consent. But
so far, I'm not going to say anything. I want to jinx it.
Yeah, right. Okay, that's page 8. Page 9. Page 10, additional contracts. 9S, I have a potential conflict on. Is that correct? I assume so. If it's a water line, they're probably tearing up the street someplace. All right. And is that's probably also true with 9T. Okay. I have a question on 9T. It doesn't have anything to do with the award or anything. It has to do more with the combining that with the light rail construction. Is that a permitted question, or can I just not discuss this one at all? Because how does that work with the... I will have a conflict, I suppose. Well, we won't be doing it during my... Well, yeah, I guess.
Mayor, is the question going to impact the approval or disapproval of this item? Then I would recommend you not ask it now. Maybe you can ask it privately, because if it's really going not towards the award of this contract, if it's going towards its interaction with the light rail, we can handle it that way.
I will not ask it then. All right. Tom?
A question about the interaction of this contract with the light rail. I was wondering if you could clarify that for me.
Mayor Hawker, Councilmember Rawls, they affect each other. They're not directly related. This is a federal aid ITS project that was programmed some time ago, and it will provide us a fiber optic path to connect with the light rail traffic control system. So it'll use a combination of existing conduit and new conduit and allow us to connect directly with the controllers that will be at the signalized intersections along light rail. So they're complementary but not directly tied. tied to each
other. And the phasing of the construction is such that we won't be duplicating, tearing up streets or whatever so that we
That's
can
correct.
Move them together?
That's correct.
Okay, Karnat thinks he may have covered all of his issues, but he's not sure.
Very good questions. All right, that's page 11, page 12. Additional contracts, page 13. Introduction of ordinances. And then we have take action on resolutions. Page 14, additional resolutions. All on consent. Page 15. Mike?
11H, I believe I have a conflict on because of the Child Crisis Center. Page 15.
Okay. I'm going to pull 11H, and just I'm going to be voting against these applications for the Indian community in hopes that we can change the law somehow to have an allocation to the city so the city can distribute that money. This application process, I don't know enough about Father's Resource Center in Mesa and Bridging Arizona Furniture Bank. Some of the applications that are listed under here, I don't have a clue what they're about. I'm not really interested in studying them all because it seems to be just a process that they come through, we have to approve them and send them on. Or we need to establish some type of council ranking process or subcommittee that can look at these things so they just don't appear on our agenda. So out of just principle, I'm going to be voting against this one, and hopefully the new council or somebody else can change this procedure that we go through, because I think it's there's no good ranking way of doing this outside of turning it over to one staff member. So if it would be removed, please. That's page 15. I want to, on 11L, I really appreciate that being on there. The policy number two is going, this is approving this, the City of Mesa's financial policies are recommended by the Audit and Finance Committee. I appreciate those policies coming forward. Number two is fund balances to have a target of 8 to 10%. And policy number eight is, again, emphasizing our short and long range up to 20 years financial planning model that we will run our budget items through. So good work for the Finance and Audit Committee. Kyle.
Say, this was also an important element of our discussion with the bond rating agencies that we implement, actually implement the policies that we're talking about, and that had a bearing on the what their rating was for us.
Right. Now, the policies are being set up here by resolution. What, if any, impact does a council then have if they do not abide by this resolution? Do they just modify it before they violate it, or how does that work?
Mayor, I guess it depends on the extent to which we consider it a violation. Because these are policies, there's some interpretation and discretion involved in analyzing whether you are following them or not. I think if there is a change, the council should review the policies and make that change before they take action. But I think there's a certain level of discretion, and there's no black and white of where the policy begins and ends, I think, in the analysis.
But, Mayor, I think the consequence, going back to Councilman Jones's point, is we've represented to the rating agencies and to those who purchase our bonds that these are the policies that we're going to follow to give them certain assurance against risk against our payment of bonds. So while maybe internally we can justify, you know, maybe trying to do something different, I think we have to be very careful, because we actually, as Councilman Jones said, they actually request a copy of these policies and look for that endorsement or approval by the council, and they are sitting in their files, and they use that in the determination, and it's referred to in their write-ups, if you recall, in the write-ups of their of the analysis they do for the city, the assumption that we're going to follow these guidelines. So I think it is very important that if we were to change them, we need to come back to the process of the council approval, but understand the consequences by third parties that review our finances.
Okay. And I like the intertie between number two and number eight, in that if you do an 8 to 10% fund balance, but you also do a long-term projection, it may be that you need a fund balance of 12% or 14% because you have debt service requirements. Over the long haul, it's going to pull it down out year three or four. So it may be 1 or 2 years you may exceed it. But that doesn't mean you can spend that money. It's programmed for future years in order to stabilize the long haul. So nice job on that one. Page 16, then. Okay, 12B and C are off. We've talked about those before. Page 17. Could somebody give us a little update on 12G, if that's possible, on the modify the street improvement, public street improvements adjacent to developing property? What's the impact of that financially? How does that work? Is there anybody that can do that one? I know Councilmember Walters wanted to pull that. Okay. She's absent, but I got a memo, so let's pull it from consent, too.
Okay.
Trying to do a compare and contrast between what we used to do and what we have today and what the financial impact would be.
Right. Basically, what this does, it requires developers to complete all of the street improvements adjacent to their properties. One of the problems that we have with this program is that it's a challenge for us to budget on an annual basis because we don't know which developments are going to come in and which are going to ask for their city share component. On average, we budget approximately $3 million a year for city share. Sometimes it's over that. The last couple of years, it's been less than that, but that's kind of an average that we shoot for. We've got some city share agreements that have been out there for, quite frankly, years. They may or may not come in. We have others that just, you know, come through, get their city share agreement and move directly into development. So it's a little hard to know exactly the number, but again, on average, we budget about $3 million a year.
So if somebody buys property on a six-lane arterial that has no road through it, let's say the GM Proving Ground, we know it's going to be a six-lane, it's on our master plan, what would have been the developer's contribution before in the cities, and what would it be today? Didn't the city build 24-foot? And then the developer built the rest, or how did that used to go forward? I thought there was something like that.
Mayor Hawker, under the current practice and policy, the developer is responsible for 24 feet, including curb, gutter, sidewalk. Right, 24 feet is the maximum amount the developer is responsible for, his half.
So he's,
and anything beyond that with, for a, if it were to be a five-lane street or a six-lane, seven-lane street, the city would contribute to, would potentially pay that cost for that extra pavement in the middle. Not the curb, gutter, sidewalk and all that, but just the extra pavement.
So then the fight becomes whether it's a 24-foot arterial or whether it's a six-lane arterial. And the developer's going to say, nah, 24-foot's fine, and city's going to say, build six lanes because you're paying for it all anyway.
Well, we have a council-adopted plan that indicates what the streets are supposed to be.
All right, so if somebody's buying real estate, they could find a council-adopted plan to see what the street width would be before they purchase the property?
Absolutely. The Mesa 2025 transportation plan outlines all the streets that are supposed to be six lanes, the ones that are planned for four lanes. Now, inside the development, sometimes you'll have, typically it's just the arterial streets that are subject to this extra width beyond what the developer would be required to do under the current policy. That would cover up to a 48-foot total width street, 24 on each side. But you could have a development that, based on their development, they may need an internal street that's wider if it's very high, intense use. And typically, even under today, if the internal streets need to be wider because of the type of development, the developer will typically bear the all of the cost for those streets.
Okay. And what happens when we switch from a county road arterial to a...
Well, right now, if a developer builds adjacent to a county arterial roadway, say Southern and Signal Butte, for example, Southern is still in the county, the developer has to pay 100% of the cost to improve the half street to whatever the county requirement is. The county has no cost participation program like we do, and that doesn't seem to stop anybody from developing on those streets, but we don't have any cost exposure because the street's outside the city. If the same street were inside the city and the developer chooses to participate in city share, we would pay for the cost of the pavement beyond the 24 feet and typically a portion of the street lights as well.
Okay. Is this a policy? Is there any uniformity between ourselves and like Gilbert or other communities where we share a common edge? I'm thinking Meridian Road with Pinal County, and I think Baseline. Well, I think we have an agreement on Baseline, but Power Road comes to an example, because I know that we built one side of Power Road from Baseline to Guadalupe, and the other side didn't get built, but development went in on it. I was trying to figure out, so what's the consistency going to be?
Mayor Hawker, on Power Road specifically, we have an IGA with the town of Gilbert, which outlines the town and the city have agreed which portions of Power Road each will eventually take. What we've done when developers have come in, well, basically, if they come into the section where Mesa will ultimately take the road, Gilbert agrees to require Mesa standards, vice versa in the section that Gilbert's ultimately going to take, but all of it's predicated on the county agreeing to it because the county still has the road, and we typically don't want to annex the road until it's approved because it would give us more financial exposure to making contributions. In some cases, instead of having the developer build the road, we get an in-lieu payment or a payment in lieu of construction, and that has happened in some cases on Power Road, because we had a RTP project to improve Power Road that was scheduled to happen in the near future. But we do coordinate when we're along the border to make sure that the on Baseline, for example, much of Baseline in the east part of the city is actually Gilbert's jurisdiction. When we have a development on the north side of Baseline, Development Services requires the developer to provide documentation from Gilbert that what he's showing in his plans meets Gilbert's requirements before they'll issue permits for the developer to go ahead. So,
yeah, I think there was an agreement way back when on Baseline. I think Peggy Rubach was actually mayor, where we did the first several miles and then they did the rest of it. So it goes okay. My last question on this is, did this go through any other committees? I think I received an email from Craig Ahlstrom and wanted to know whether the development community input was solicited on this or not.
Right. We actually went through. Okay, we went through the Transportation Infrastructure Committee. This was actually brought forward at the request of Councilmember Truitt. We have sent email notifications out to the development community through our Developers Advisory Forum email list. We've got over 300 notifications on that. We've sent it out at least twice after this came through the last time. I sent a separate email with a kind of a bullet point. So we tried to do everything we could to make sure the development community was aware that this was coming forward now.
Not just tell them, were they involved in the change of policy? Was there discussion on the merits of it?
At the last time we had a face-to-face developers advisory forum, this was not yet scheduled to come forward. So, no, we have not had that discussion with them. We've done it basically through email so that they'd know that it was coming forward.
So does it usually come forward to council before you've had the discussion with the developers?
Typically, when we have new fees or changes in policy, we try to schedule it so that we can have that face-to-face meeting. We only do that on a quarterly basis with developers advisory forums. So this came forward after that last meeting that we had with them.
All right. And the $3 million that was mentioned, is that an annual?
That's an average that we budget through transportation for the street improvements. But it just depends on which projects come forward as to what the actual amount is each year.
And if I could add on that, the history more recently it's been, the actual experience has been more about $1 million a year. But if you go back a little bit farther, say in the 5 to 10 years, we've had some where it's been well above that.
Okay.
$3-4 million a year.
Kyle's going to be around next year for a couple of years at least, and he wants to know if that $1 million is in the budget or not.
I believe
we already.
Mayor, the way this is budgeted, and the point here is, I think,
if I recall from the discussion, is one of the things we do, the way we do it today is actually kind of unique in the process around the valley. What we're actually, I think we're trying to move towards is actually right. being more what every how every, the other cities deal with the streets. Right now, the burden for the city to come up with city share is actually funded from bonds. And frankly, that's one of the reasons that the next bond election is so critical. If you're a developer, because if the bonds aren't approved, city share funds aren't available. And so we will be very difficult for us to participate in the regional component of capital infrastructure in the future because of that. On the utility side, we'd be fine, but on this component, that's how, if you'll go back to the proposed bond package, there is an element in there that includes city share amount for the next 5 years. I think it was set at around, again, $3 million or so that's already budgeted, but anticipated in the next bond election.
As far as I know, there are no other cities that have a program similar to city share. Mesa is unique in how we contribute to those regional improvements.
Right. Kyle.
And we did have this in our discussion of the Transportation Infrastructure Committee. One, it's already allocated in the budget historically, but it was more getting in line with what everybody else is doing. Developers who are developing everywhere else in the valley are used to how everybody else is doing it, and we're unique. If they're not developing outside the city, they're uncomfortable with it because they're used to city share and like that program. But our intent was basically to get in line with everybody else.
Okay. So if you have a one-acre lot on a major arterial intersection, you're going to have a lot of infrastructure improvements to develop that one-acre lot.
Well, it goes along with the philosophy of development paying for itself, because if that particular development doesn't pay for it, then somehow the rest of the city is going to have to come up with that improvement.
Right. Okay. Any other questions? Daryl?
Well, the only thing I was going to add to that is that this is, Mesa is the only city that's been doing this for many, many years. It's been providing, I'll call this assistance, some might call it a subsidy to the development process. And the other thing is that in addition, a lot of communities don't do this and have some component of street impact fees in addition to pay for the impacts to intersections and signalizations and transportation control centers and all kinds of other costs that are an outcome of growth. So I just would add that to the conversation.
Okay. Well, we're putting a whole lot of pressure then on the master plan and the engineering, because if you ever have to do a widening and you've missed the capacity of that road, that's going to be very expensive. And I think there's a couple of them, one up in Los Endes, not quite as you go up, that's a huge road. I forgot which one it is, but I think we overbuilt that one. So good luck for engineering. It's going to
I think there are some examples where things were built wider than they should have been.
Was that Thomas?
I think we've got a handle on that.
Probably Thomas.
Yeah. Okay. All right. We'll hear more about that, I think, on Monday. 18, we get into zoning cases. Continued on 19. Is 12K the Riverview area? Is that what we have on that?
Yes,
ma'am. All right.
So,
I know.
Right.
That north of university thing always throws
me. North of university part that looks a little suspicious in the district.
Why don't we put north of 8th Street or something?
Well, it's actually immediately south of
202
of the no of Bass Pro Drive.
Wow, same thing.
There you go.
Yeah,
I mean that's the most specific one.
Yeah. Okay, we had that before. All right, that's page 19, page 20.
How come
Mike?
How come 12L is off?
Did you pull that, Scott?
It's District 2 Pawn Shop.
Yeah. Last week.
Want to keep it off?
Yeah.
All right. Then page 20. We have a split decision from P&Z on the one at 307 South Haas Road. We get too many 4-3s. And then we get Los Endes, parcel 51. It's on page 20, 21. Continues. Subdivision plats and items from citizens present. Any questions on the Monday night's agenda?
6 hours for the meeting.
Might be.
Yeah. sending us out with a long one.
Yeah. Item number two is hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on fiscal year 08-09 human services funding.
Question for the city attorney.
Sure.
Yeah, just a question as to how we proceed with this. Overall, I can look at funding, but individually, I forget how we do this.
With regard to specific recommendations for organizations that you have a conflict with, you should not discuss either increasing or decreasing the funding for that entity. With regard to other entities that you do not have a conflict with, you can participate in the discussion whether to increase or decrease that funding.
And we will split out the vote so that I can vote on the others and not
yes.
on. That's how we'll do that.
Well, actually.
Well, that's right. These will come before the new council.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
No sweat.
Makes it easier. Please.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. I'm Carolyn Olson, Director of the Housing Revitalization Division. With me today is Lisa Wilson. Lisa Wilson, our Human Services Program Coordinator. And we are here today to seek direction on the allocations for funding for the ABC Fund and also for the general fund programs. And with that, I will turn it over to Lisa Wilson.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. Today we are going to talk about the allocations recommended by the Human Services Advisory Board and staff. There's a spreadsheet with your packet, and you can follow along with that spreadsheet. This slide shows the differences in funding between 07-08 and 08-09. Right now, we have $839,000 to allocate to nonprofit agencies for human services. And of the $1.3 million requested in funding, there's going to be about $500,000 that is going to be unfunded programs. The Human Services Board works very hard in reviewing these applications. There's a six-step process that they go through to get to today and making their recommendations to you. When they review the applications, they do use the community safety support model. And the safety support model is one that looks at programs that would help police and fire services kind of lessen the impact on those services to Mesa residents, to the fire and police. They also look at avoiding duplication of services and programs that don't have a clear outcome. Those usually will not get funded. I'm not going to read that to you, but you'll have that information. We do have five funding areas and priorities given to the crisis programs. If you look at your spreadsheet, you can follow along here. The areas that are highlighted in yellow is where the board's recommendations and the staff recommendations are different. Crisis services gets the majority of the funding. We have prevention services, and these programs are youth at-risk programs. They deal with mentoring and counseling of our youth. We also have transitional services, and this helps folks become self-sufficient. We have the long-term system support programs, and these are to help folks maintain independence or a semi-independent lifestyle. Here is a list of the unfunded programs. And as I stated, about the approximately $500,000 is going to be unfunded programs. This is included, but it also includes the decrease in the ABC and the general fund dollars. For 08-09, we're going to serve approximately 340,000 individuals. And of the $839,000 that Mesa supplements, $19 million of the nonprofit agencies' budgets will be included. We have a ratio of about a dollar. If we put in a dollar, we get $23 back into the community, invested into the community through the human services programs. Next year, I'm going to be talking to the board and trying to find out if we can allocate the ABC and general fund dollars as one lump sum, because with the ABC dollars decreasing the way they are, those programs that received ABC dollars have taken a bigger decrease in allocations. Also with ABC program, we're looking at an online form where people can apply to give to the ABC program more often. All they have to do is sign up online and it will be deducted out of their utility payments. We also are talking to Bank of America, trying to find out if there's a way to resolve the online banking problem with folks putting their money into doing the online banking through their utilities, and then the extra amount that they donate ends up being credited to their bank account, to their utility account, because it just doesn't decipher that the extra dollar. They just get a credit. And so again, these are our the staff and the board's recommendations, and we are looking to the city council to approve those recommendations today.
Okay. I have two quick ones. You said you serve 340,000 individuals?
Yeah, the program.
460,000 people in Mesa, you serve almost two-thirds of the people?
The programs that we have, these organizations have told us these are how many people they will serve. And so what we did was we accumulated through all the applications we looked at, we added all those numbers served per application, and that's the number that we came up with.
Oh, you could.
Some of them can be duplicated.
Unique individuals.
Exactly. So if someone's looking for transitional housing, they can also go to United Food Bank and get a food box.
Do you have any clue on how many unique individuals out of a population of 460,000 we have instead of the cumulative? I mean, somebody could use several services and do it 365 days a year, and that could be 2,000 or 3,000 for one individual.
That is true, and I do not have that number.
Okay. And what was the $1 to 23?
Yes, with the $839,000 that the city is allocating,
right?
The agencies, it makes about, out of all the total agencies that we're proposing to fund, their budgets total $19 million. And so we use that $23 as what would be reinvested back into the community through those dollars.
Yeah, but they get other state, they get United
Way. Yes, they get funding from
our contribution doesn't multiply
very small
times 23.
Price.
All right. Okay. All right. And what about the $6,000 difference here between the committee and the RSVP and caring group? Staff is recommending not.
Staff recommended
incurring?
Not to fund those programs, but the board voted to fund them, and in doing so, they had to remove money from other programs.
Okay. So we have accept the staff recommendation, the committee's recommendation, or modify and change is
exactly
the three options here, mm-hmm. basically. All right. Questions? Scott.
I have a quick question. I'm back on slides 7 and 8. Under your investment model for funding guidelines, number 5 says prevent long-term dependence on public resources. And then your funding areas, your fourth area is long-term support. How is the long-term support not suddenly becoming long-term dependence on funding resources?
How is it not?
Yeah.
Well, the long-term support programs are the ones that help folks become independent. So if you look at the programs that we have proposed to fund in that area, they are for the elderly, helps with the home-delivered meals, and.
Right, and they look like good programs. I'm just asking, so for let's just take one. For the home-delivered meals as long-term support, is that long-term as in over the recovery from an illness or injury? Are we going to temporarily, is that going to be a bridge program into some privately funded charitable organization, or are we talking about long-term supply of food to people who are homebound for years?
These are homebound folks, and it could be for years. Some of them are recovering from a surgery. They're you know, elderly and they can't provide for themselves, so that program would provide that. And I'm not sure how long that could be.
Yeah. Again, I'm not going to pass judgment on the program because I think it's an essential program, but it doesn't seem to jive with one of the investment model goals of preventing long-term dependence. If this were a program that started delivering home-served meals and then we help these folks transition into long-term care, into nursing homes or something, that would be a bridge program that seems mm-hmm. to be appropriate, but I don't know how this goal.
But Mayor, Councilman Summers, you picked one of the unique programs that has that specific demographic, but if you look at some of the others, that's their intention.
The different programs will
help achieve what your the goals here of helping to prevent the long-term dependence. I mean, at some point, though, when you're an elderly homebound person, there isn't really programs or projects that can rehabilitate them and necessarily get them back out in the community. So this is just that's where this program comes into play.
I don't know that I agree with that statement. Well, maybe not in a charitable sense, but there are programs and organizations that for-profit or even faith-based organizations that work to help rehabilitate. And again, we're just picking on one program, but rehabilitate the elderly. Where else was I going to go? Oh, Kino had touched on it just ever so briefly about how we're tracking the use of these dollars. We're tracking specifically the people that are using them.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a sense that we weren't doing any tracking of the 390,000 mm-hmm. contacts, 340,000 contacts. How are we ensuring, without tracking and using some of those statistics, how are we making sure that we aren't getting the same folks year after year after year after year utilizing these programs or a number of these different programs and in that way creating a long-term dependency on these programs as well? Should we not be tracking the usage? Well, and
actually, Councilmember Summers, the agencies do report to us how many individuals they served, and they also give us demographics on those individuals. Now, as far as being duplicated, that would be really hard for them to track. It depends on really what the services are they're providing. If it's shelter services, those numbers can be tracked through the homeless, the HMIS system, which is the Homeless Information Management System. So it just depends on what the services are.
I appreciate the funding areas and how they're lined up. I don't have any heartburn over, at least from what I can see, over who we're providing the funding to. I do have some of that concern, though, over prevent long-term dependency is a good objective of the mm-hmm. program, but I'm not really sure that it's been institutionalized as much as it's been a bullet point on a slide, so that's something I think needs to be looked at over the next year.
Okay.
Thank you, Mayor.
You're looking for some direction, too, so I personally forgot to mention it, but I support the staff's direction on the 6,000.
So do I.
Move forward. All right. Dennis.
Just a question and then a comment. The ABC funding, you're projecting basically a 30% drop between this year and this last year. What's the reason for that? Have you done any analysis of this, or has our marketing for it been eliminated? Why has it gone down so drastically?
Our marketing has not been eliminated for ABC.
Mm-hmm.
There could be various reasons why. The economy could be a reason. It could be the online banking, trying to disseminate that extra dollar. There could be a number of reasons for that. And no, we have not done a major analysis of that to find out why that is. But we are trying to do things to increase the fund.
Yeah, it's a concern. It seems to me this is the lowest figure since the ABC program was mm-hmm. instituted.
Yes. And we did have matching dollars to go along with the ABC program a few years back. And when the match dollars went away, it did lower the fund considerably.
Right. And then just a comment, Mayor. I support the recommendations that the staff and the committee have made. My observation, however, is that I think we're moving in the wrong direction in terms of funding. Over the past number of years, while the city has grown and the needs have grown, the dollars for human services funding have decreased. And in a difficult economic time, the needs of the community continue to grow. And this is an area, as is public safety, where I think you have to make sure you have adequate funds to deal with this issue. Moreover, I think we're going to see an increased burden on our community with returning men and women from the service. We know there's going to be lots of issues with that the federal government simply is not equipped to deal with, and yet the burden will fall on local communities. We put our agencies through a very rigorous process of application and review for a dwindling amount of dollars. And at some point, you know, the rate of return for the agencies is going to be so small that to be de minimis. I quite frankly, I think that the council should be looking to increasing the funds in this particular area, or at least holding the line, given the needs of the community. Thanks.
Okay, Tom.
One question about the second East Valley Senior Citizens line under the system support, long-term support. The amount requested was $1,400. The amount recommended by both the staff and the city and the committee is $3,400 higher. How did that come about?
Councilmember Rawls, the agency requested $18,000, and what the staff looked at was general fund dollars matching with that to try to make that program as whole as possible, and so that's where that came from.
So basically, those two are just really one item, just two different funding
exactly.
sources.
And
okay, that explains it.
That's Mayor and Councilmember Rawls, and that goes to the last bullet I think you saw, where we're going to get away from kind of segregating these funding sources and combine them so we don't have that kind of confusion.
Okay. Thank you. I support the staff recommendation as well.
Okay. Says provide direction.
Really, Mayor, what we heard
any objections to staff's recommendation as opposed to the committee's? All right. That's the direction.
Thank you.
Just to put on the record, I need to declare a conflict on that because most of the funding goes to my agencies.
Right. A duplicate. I've done recent work, so I have to... Right. Lose myself.
Okay. We still have four left.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay.
Up there, but I don't have
four. Another rock. I had a request to delay item number 3. Is that correct, Dennis?
Yes.
All right. Okay. Item number 4, hear a presentation, discuss and provide direction on fiscal year 08-09 transit budget.
Good morning, Mayor and Council. My name is Mike James. I'm in the Transportation Department. 2 weeks ago, we came and gave you a brief notice that we had a funding budget issue that we wanted to do some research and get back with you. And I've got a short presentation to go over our findings and recommendation as well. As you recall, back in January, we identified approximately $1.4 million in savings and bus service reductions, most notably reducing the Saturday bus service to 1 hour frequency, which has been implemented, and then in this July starting with some midday service reductions on Gilbert Road Route 136. As I mentioned 2 weeks ago, we're approximately $669,000 higher for the cost to run our bus and dial ride services for next year. The reason for those higher costs really come down to a few items. The labor contract was renegotiated every 3 years, and RPTA has done that. There were some, what I'd say, minimal operator wage increases, as well as some health insurance costs and workers' comp costs that were increased, along with some significant fuel cost increase. I think the important thing to know is that our staff met with RPTA, and we were clear that we need to get accurate budget information sooner for our process, and we're not alone with the other cities in that regard. As far as the LTAP-2 or Powerball funding, it's still uncertain at this time. However, we did get notice if it is not swept away, our share is approximately $631,000. So if that does come through, and we should know in the end of June, that will be our amount. What we've done here today is put together two alternatives, and actually we're seeking for you to look at both of these because we may need to implement both of them
yeah.
if we can. Going through the alternatives, the first point is increasing our fare assumption 2%. We think this is a prudent move in the fact that we've eliminated transfers and changed the fare structure so that we should be getting a greater return on the our fares for the system as well as new fare boxes and computer systems. The $80,000 was a maintenance credit that RPTA eliminated from our contract, so that was a savings. The $70,000 is really advancing the one-time savings that we have for the month of May and June and part of July for the one-hour service reductions on Saturday. So we would be taking that savings that we are accruing right now and forwarding that into the next budget year. The LTAP funding in Alternative A is really assuming that we could use 400 of that approximate $600,000 and move forward in that way. However, if the LTAP 2 funding is not available and we find that out in mid or late June, then we would go to implement Alternative B. Alternative B has all the same credit and savings you see in the first three bullets, in addition to eliminating Saturday and weekday service on the Gilbert Road route. The Gilbert Road route is really the only route that we can individually eliminate because it's not impacted by Title VI related to low-income or minority populations. It's also a route that's twice in the morning and twice in the evening serves Falcon Field and Boeing, and I've got a map to show that. And additionally, through Prop 400 and the Regional Transportation Plan, this route will be funded 7 days a week starting in July 2009. So if we did eliminate it this year, this upcoming year, in July 2009 fiscal year, it would be coming back. You can see this is the route here twice in the morning.
I've got a question for you.
Sure.
Tom?
Is the regional decision to run this route up to Boeing and Falcon Field on Sunday because of the heavy use by the employees at McDonnell Douglas and Falcon Field on Sunday?
No, that would just be a weekday extension for commuters, really.
But you're saying it's going to be run 7 days a week now once the region takes over. Why would the region run a route up into that area on Sunday?
They haven't. In fact, we haven't even discussed how we're going to address that route when the region comes on, because technically we'll still pay, City of Mesa will still pay for that extension.
So, Mike,
it's not regionally funded entirely in 09 or 09 or 10 or 09 10.
The main line is the extension is a Mesa.
Okay.
Sorry.
Thank you.
So, really, what we're seeking today is to, at this time, move forward with Alternative A, assume LTAP 2 funding is coming in. If we find out next month that it is not, we will come back, say that we need to implement Alternative B and reduce or eliminate the service on Route 136 Gilbert Road. So.
Okay, you got options outlined either way on the LTAP money, so what do you need? Anything to discuss and provide direction? I'd say just wait and see.
Well, we just wanted the council to be aware of the options, make sure as we move forward in the budget, this is the two options we'll consider.
I know that there's going to be somebody wanting to do bridge funding until July of 2009 to keep the route so that there's some usage, so that it doesn't just go dormant and then bring it back to life. It would be interesting to do some type of projection on what that costs to reestablish the route. The other one I would, on that little extension, look at vans and all the other different options that they have to get those riders up to Boeing. So maybe in the interim you can explore some of that on ride sharing and van pools and such.
Okay.
Any other questions on item number four? All right, let's move on then to five. Here, a presentation, discuss and provide direction on the use of electronic monitoring as a substitute for bond under pretrial conditions for misdemeanor defendants. We have a discussion here to approve it. I concur. I think it's a great program, especially as outlined, where the judge has the discretion. If there's somebody that shouldn't be electronic monitored, they still can say, nope, put them, you know, arrest them and put them in jail. So I think its policies are covered well, and it's a demonstration trial project. Any objections? Scott?
I guess just one quick question. Can you give me a bullet point on who would be allowed and who would not be allowed on this under the policy? Bullet point real quick.
No firemen.
No firemen. You have to catch us first.
Yes, Your Honor, and Councilmember Summers, this is a graphic that I put together because I'm a very visual person and a layperson. As you all know, the court's whole process is very complicated and convoluted in some respects, and for good reason, because of due process requirements. But if you'll look in the category or the column of the arrested, these are people who are arrested by our police officers and brought to our in-custody court. And you'll see that there is some jail time. These are the people that would be held on bond by our judges and go to jail. So the people who are eligible for this ankle bracelet potentially would be people who had gone to jail, were held on bond, and chose to stay in jail for that time period until they came forward for their pretrial, or people who were released on bond. And sometimes it takes up to 4 or 5 days to actually process bonds and get out of jail, so there's still some jail time costs to the city. So those are the two populations of people that have been defined as potentially eligible for the use of the ankle bracelet.
So these would be nonviolent offenders, DUI where there were no injuries involved, shoplifting, other minor misdemeanors would be allowed, but anything?
It's really more in the criminal misdemeanor area.
It's going to be up to the discretion of the judge. Any individuals who are detained, so they're arrested and they are in jail, when they come in for in-custody arraignment, that will be a discussion between the prosecutor, the judge, and the defendant. But ultimately, the decision will be made by the judge.
And if I could, Mayor, Paul, one of the things that I think gave me some, I guess, assurance is this technology that's being used, or we're adopting, that's already being used today, is currently being used for some pretty severe.
That's correct. And I have Albert Lemke here, Deputy Court Administrator, that's been working with the technology and did all the groundwork on the numbers to get to the report today. But Superior Court's currently using this for felons, and anyone convicted of a sex offense is required for lifetime electronic monitoring, and those are on this system as well. So there's some fairly serious people being monitored through this system.
And so, but we're now taking that technology, though, using a much lesser,
that's correct,
kind of crime. So I guess I'm just trying to assure that the technology feel pretty confident about, because it's already being used.
But those offenses are, I'm not a court person, but those offenses aren't part of the judicial or the city court.
No, and in city not, court, yeah, city court are all misdemeanor offenses. But the judge will still have the discretion. If they believe that this individual defendant has committed the crime and the judge is not comfortable using the ankle bracelet program, he certainly has that discretion.
You know, certainly at the misdemeanor level, there is a presumption for release. OR release, according to court rules, you know, there's a presumption of innocence prior to trial, so there is a strong presumption for release. In lieu of OR, you would go to a bond. Judge would set a bond primarily to assure that defendant's coming back to court and going to show up. The bond's held as security. So the weight of this is for release pre-trial. Post-trial, it's another situation. And this is especially true at the misdemeanor level. So if there is an established security and comfort at the felony level, I think we're pretty assured that we're okay at the misdemeanor level, except for those cases where the judge might feel and the prosecutor has input that there might be a basis for setting a high bond and holding someone, and they will certainly do that.
I think the example here in our staff report, it provides ultimate flexibility for city judges to apply this justice tool when they believe it is appropriate. For example, there may be domestic violence cases where a judge might be inclined to hold a defendant on a significant bond to ensure victim safety.
That's correct.
I appreciate the bullet point outline on the staff report. Tom?
Just to help clarify, that there are no misdemeanors where people are non-bondable. I mean, there are some felonies and some circumstances where people cannot, the judge has the discretion to set no bond, and they have to stay in jail. If you have them, you can't be held on a misdemeanor because you're always entitled to bond. So what we're saying here is both because a lot of people can't post a $500 bond, although they can certainly, they're responsible people who can come to court and will come to court. This just gives us an additional flexible tool over and above the OR release. It says, you know, you're not quite entitled to an OR, your contacts with the community are not quite strong enough, we got a little concern, but a $300 or a $500 bond is beyond your budget, so we really don't want you sitting in jail for no good reason just because you can't pay, because that cost is borne by the city. So let's do this program, cut the cost by 30 or 60% or 70%, and still have the person come back to the court. It's not a question where we're going to release people who have been convicted. It's not a question of where we're going to be releasing people who are non-bondable. We're not releasing people who are a true danger to the community, because the judges retain the discretion where if they think that the danger exists, they can set a high bond and not impose the ankle bracelet monitoring device. So I think it's a brilliant program.
Right. The out of custody arraignment and some of the dollar figures you have on page two, how does that fit into the electronic monitoring?
Mayor, members of council, we when we looked at this initially, and what's going to happen is that the more defendants we put on electronic monitoring, they're essentially coming out of the in-custody court system. They'll be much like a cited and released defendant, so they'll be coming into our regular court divisions. That's a workload that's coming in. So we coupled the discussion to possibly in the future funding our arraignment division, which we're piloting currently. We've had a judicial position out there on a bond for about 3 or 4 years. The day's going to come where we'll have to someday add a judge. So what is the most productive thing we can do when that day comes? And that would be to try to fund and resource the arraignment division. The reason that's important is because the arraignment is the first defendant appearance at court. If you're able to settle that case at arraignment, it stops right there. It doesn't continue through the system, incurring costs and resources. Most courts are moving to this model. Phoenix has moved to this model, and they're settling about 59% of their cases at arraignment, so the case stops right at arraignment. Now, consequentially, that'll provide relief in the other court divisions so that we can then absorb the additional pretrials that might be coming in because of electronic release. So even though we're piloting this thing, we're going to do as many defendants as we can to realize those savings. Somewhere down the line, I think it would be appropriate to look at the possibility of maybe resourcing that arraignment division.
Okay, so some of the savings, the way this is outlined, right. I thought the decisions were simultaneously. We're going to try electronic and we're doing this at the same time. That's not the case? How does it progress from one to the...
Right. Mayor, what we would do, and Paul brought up some very good points about where we'd like to get to. The concern we have is we've already made a presumption that we're going to save about $800,000 through this program that's built into the current budget. Mm-hmm. And so we first need to cover those costs. I think the work that's been done by Paul and Natalie looking at the program is the possibility those could do much better than that. And we want to, but I want to, before we commit to expending those resources now, we want to give it a little time to see how, if savings are realized. You know, if we do see that realization of savings, I think Paul's point is, let's just continue to seed in other programs that will continue to improve or even mitigate against cost to the system in the future. These costs today, the jail costs that we're trying to save, are currently in the police department budget. And so we've reduced their budget by $800,000. Yeah. So that progressively, Mayor, that's where we want to get to. We just didn't want to commit to funding the arraignment court right now until we had time to see the program work. If it works, I think that's where we go to.
Okay, Tom?
Yeah, a couple of points. This will work, and I don't want to be perceived as trying to influence the judiciary as to how they decide individual release situations, but I would hate to see us get into the mode of imposing this in lieu of ORs, because then we're bearing a cost that we don't have, with the own with. And I know it's an additional security, but I still think, as you said, Paul, the tendency, the presumption with misdemeanors is that people should be released on their own recognizance, and that's going to be a psychological issue that's going to need to be addressed. We don't want to slide from OR.
What's an OR?
Own recognizance, no bond. You're on your promise to appear. So we don't want to slide from the presumption into a different presumption that carries a cost, because the OR release does not carry a cost. So just again,
Councilmember Walls, you're absolutely correct, and we've been looking fairly critically at the ABA standards, which suggests exactly what you're saying. So I think, from a focus and attention point of view with the judges, I think that's where we'll be.
And the second thing I don't want it to interfere with is this attempted focus on resolving cases at the arraignment. Again, if we think, if we start defaulting to, well, I always have the option of releasing this person on with an ankle bracelet, maybe the pressure to resolve the case at the first court hearing isn't as great, so let's keep that focus on trying to resolve as many cases as we can. Again, assuring that justice is done to all sides.
Yeah, there's a lot of positive things that can result from this that we'll have opportunities for that we didn't before.
And I'm just identifying a couple of negatives that we need to resist.
And, one thing, for example, is from a qualitative point of view, if a defendant is held on bond and they're sitting down at the sheriff's jail, they have limited access to their attorney. It's limited by phone. They're sitting down there 14, 16 days. Electronic release, they have access to their attorney. They can be a little more deliberate about their circumstances, their case, and making a more informed decision with respect to the plea later or whatever we do. So there's a huge qualitative aspect that I think gets delivered when we do this.
And hopefully they can also be out in the community earning the money with which to pay the fines that they may get imposed later. So, but I mean, you're sitting in jail for 16 days, you lose your job, you lose your house. I mean, it's just... And the third thing is that I would like us to consider that somewhere down the road, where the state law does not prohibit it, the use of electronic monitoring for home detention or whatever on convicted misdemeanor offenders. Because again, except in a few cases where state law says the defendant must pay for the jail time, once we sentence somebody, the city has to pay for that jail time as well. And if we can put them on home arrest with this kind of technology, I think it's something to explore.
To my knowledge, we'll be the first misdemeanor court to employ electronic monitoring. So all of the potential that brings along those lines, I think we'll try to exploit later. But we do have some logistics to work through. We have to make sure the technology works. We have to make procedural adjustments, track the workload, and a lot of upfront things we have to do to say that this is really, you know, viable and we can run with it. So I think we can do that. I think it's very positive. I think we're very encouraged about taking this direction. And at long last, we're doing something about the jail bill.
Right. All right. I think you have concurrence by the council to move forward with the great program. Discuss and provide directions on the planning area boundaries in Pinal County. Let me see if I can kind of introduce this one. This has to do with some the state trust land and the freeway, that the 10 square miles, if you remember what we were trying to protect, the arrival and departure routes for Gateway. Apache Junction was trying to... get permission to, I guess, not the city of, but a very close affiliate for the water and sewage treatment plants for that whole area. We opposed that in Pinal County, and they backed off. Queen Creek then, in their master plan, decided to take half of the 10 square miles that we designated as a planning area to incorporate in their master plan update and send it out to their voters. State Trust Land said, how come everybody's planning our land? It's, you know, kind of step back. So I think all the parties kind of got together and said, okay, let's step back. And so because we did do an action to include that 10 square miles of planning area, I wanted to bring it forward because I'm recommending that the city does step back, work with the other communities, but hopefully protect our interests by making sure that that land use is compatible, but knowing that we don't have to own it in order to or have it in our master plan in order to have that type of control. As long as the other communities will work cooperatively with us and maybe even have a separate town or something developed through you know, the state trust land reform, then I'm more than comfortable trying to be a good neighbor with the rest of them, but still having a very active and participatory role in what takes place in Pinal County, because it is our eastern border. So with that being said, the letter that's being drafted, of kind of understanding between the surrounding communities, tries to convey those type of thoughts. Don't mess with us, we won't mess with you. Let's be good neighbors, you know, all that type of thing. And there's also, I think, something in the future, it might be some, because of the freeways are funded primarily with our 12% allocation of money in the Prop 400, I always wanted to somewhat control the freeway corridor for airplane and also for any type of retail or economic benefits that you get with that freeway frontage. So there may be the potential for the new council, and I'll hopefully I'll work on this, on some type of a revenue sharing agreement for some of that area out in Pinal County, so that there isn't a sales tax war going on who's going to give away the most to get a car dealership or a regional mall. So I think this is a pristine area for that type of an arrangement to be looked at. So with that being said, I wanted to make sure that everyone was comfortable with some type of letter going over to the state trust land saying that, you know, we're pulling off collectively to work on this to make sure that this is a positive synergy for all of our communities and we get away from the parochial wars. So,
well, I'm sorry.
How's that covered?
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. That's good,
Mayor. Nice job, Scott.
Oh, yeah. I couldn't have said it better myself. So.
I assume at some point then, if the letter goes, then we would have to then, the council would have to do some kind of modification to delete that 10.5 miles from our planning area.
Yeah,
I mean, didn't we officially adopt it as part of our, included as part of our planning area?
And Mayor, Councilmember Rawls, and John Wesley can correct me, but I know we took the action. It didn't require a resolution or an ordinance to expand that. And actually, on March the 8th of 07, when we expanded the area, it was done in study session. And
right,
so if council so chooses, I believe any action this morning would be appropriate if council believes that the mayor's suggestion is moving in the right direction. And we'll continue to work on the MOU with the three parties. That is a very, very much a draft document at this point.
That's what I was thinking. It seems to me that, at least I agree with the direction. I'm just wondering if the direction bears fruit and we have a three-party agreement, then do we not at least have to have some action to terminate or withdraw the action of March of 2007.
Right. The timing on this is Queen Creek has till, I think, the 20th to either put it on or remove it from their general plan update that they're sending out to their voters. If they know that we're substantially in agreement and going to move forward, then they're going to pull that off from their citizen vote.
Right.
And then, Mayor, to that point, and maybe Scott just, I don't know, we talked about this, but Thursday we're going to do the decision theater. The following week is the idea is to bring the HDR study, the Southeast Strategic Plan, to the council. We could, as part of that discussion and action, also just make a point on the agenda, this item of withdrawing, or whatever the right word is, from this area.
And I think today we're just seeing if anybody has some serious objections of moving in that direction.
Right. Great direction.
All right.
Great.
Let's work
Thank
on
you.
The
ground. Yeah, great job, Scott.
Yeah. Good presentation.
My easiest time here. I appreciate it.
Yeah, we can talk about the fiber optics on the light rail line next time. Okay. Number six, discuss and provide direction on, let's go to seven, acknowledging receipts of various boards and committees.
Move for approval.
A motion and second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes. Hear reports on meetings and our conferences attended. You got to put on your Krispy Kreme hat as you do your report.
There we go. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, we're back.
I along with Vice Mayor Walters, was out at the ribbon cutting at 5:30 Tuesday morning at Krispy Kreme, and they had crowds.
That was 5:30 in the morning.
That was 5:30 in the morning. Yes, it was, and there were some people who had been in line since Sunday night, I believe, that wanted free donuts for a year.
Well, there's our police.
And as I understand it, going by, there were still lines out the door last night. They're doing okay.
Okay, and what about the button you're wearing? Is there some significance to that happy birthday?
Under protest, I promised my family I'd wear the happy birthday button. So.
Happy birthday.
All right. 49, right?
That's it.
And holding.
Anyone else? Meetings? Scott?
Mayor, we had an open house yesterday in my district to present the options for the Gateway Strategic Plan to citizens, and we had a really good turnout. We handed out about 40 business cards, and I know there were more people than that, so it was a really good turnout. Standing room only for that. So thanks, staff, Chris. Right.
Tom?
I don't do these very often, but I had a... Scott was bragging on his family the other day. I was up at NAU on Saturday for my niece's graduation from Northern Arizona University. It's part of the week-long activity. Not only did she graduate, she was named the Female Athlete of the Year for the university, and the NCAA presented her with a big plaque for being the number one kills per game average in volleyball and Division One volleyball across the country. I mean, she led the nation in kills per game. So kind of an exciting week for us.
Kills or spikes or what is
well,
it?
Well, it's spike can also not be can be returned, but this is where you score a point on a kill on a spike per game, and she led the nation, including all, I mean, Stanford, Nebraska, all the big powerhouses. She was the best in the country, so pretty exciting.
Is there Olympics volleyball? Is she going that
there right? Is, but about two-thirds of the way through the season, she blew out her knee, played through it, had surgery, and it is not recovering well.
All right. Anyone else? Mike? Yeah. All right. Any others? Scheduling of meetings and general information. Mr. Brady.
Yes, Mayor. I think we're going to have to update data forecast with the opening of Krispy Kreme, so maybe we can see a positive uptick. Now, just a reminder of the council, and we do have a council meeting on Monday the 19th. Please also pay attention in the Audit and Finance Committee. There was a request to bring back, I think, at least one or two of the items for the council as part of the study session prior to the council meeting, so to get some direction. So that will there will be some items that will precede the council meeting for the 19th. And then again, as I mentioned, a week from today, May 22nd, we've reserved the ASU Decision Theater for the council, and I believe we'll have enough seats for the council elect. It's very, as council members know, we did this on the Water Forum presentation. We went down there. The seating in the theater itself, I think, is limited to about 20, 25 or so. So it's not, but the in the same facility building, there's another larger conference room. So we're not going to turn anybody away. It's just that we can only put so many people actually in the theater to get the kind of the surround sound filled. The presentation still will be available in an adjacent room. So that will be next Thursday at 8 a.m. And we'll have maps, directions on how to get there. The biggest challenge, I think, for that location is really just the parking, finding the right parking down there. And then we'll have the next study session will be May 29th at 7:30. Followed that evening, May 29th, will be the mayor and council farewell for the outgoing council, and that'll be in the convention center beginning at 4 o'clock. Thank you, Mayor.
Okay. Items from citizen present. Are there any requests to speak?
Yes, Mayor, I have one. Marilyn Winnestrom.
Marilyn?
I know, 3 minutes. Mayor and council members, Marilyn Winterstrom, 1112 North Center Street. 8 months ago to the day, on October 15th, I had publicly requested information on the rental of the council chambers upstairs for public events, but mostly it would be for the newspapers. And the minutes from that meeting indicate correctly that Mr. Brady commented that each year the council approves the specific fees and charges associated with the rental of various city facilities, and that Mrs. Winterstrom could obtain a list of such fees and charges at the city clerk's office. I made out a public records request the following day, submitted to the city clerk's office, and I think it was the day after that that Linda had given me a call saying that it had been in the hands, it was in the hands of the city attorney's office. That was in October. In January, Mrs. Spinner, the city attorney, had said that they're still working on it. Okay, that's fine. Well, last Friday, I asked about it again, and she said that they would be ready at the beginning of this week, and then on Monday, I think it was Monday, he contacted me saying that an assistant of somebody in the city manager's office by the name of Natalie Lewis would have that information for me at the beginning of the week. She asked for my email address, and it would be submitted. I'm still waiting for it. I'm just thinking, are we going to have about three more elections before I can get this information? But the question remains, using what schedule of fees is that facility, the upstairs council chambers, rented out by the city? I'm still waiting for an answer. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Are there any other requests to speak this morning?
No additional ones, ma'am.
Okay. Entertain a motion to adjourn.
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All right, we're adjourned.